Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Acting Deputy Editor Sophia Wilson. Now Sophia, the script says we're in the same room, but we're not in the same room, we are in the same building.
We are in the same building. I am sat in the events cupboard because we couldn't work out how to use two microphones in the same room.
So if any podcast aficionados out there have any idea, because this is the first opportunity we've ever had recording Boat Briefing to actually be in the same room at the same time recording. So we've been waiting for this moment and we messed it up royally. We couldn't figure out how to do it.
Yeah, you're really giving the game away about quite how amateur we are at this podcasting game, Stuart.
We're 50 something episodes in and we still can't record a podcast physically in the same room at the same time. Terrible.
Anyway, aside from podcasting woes, you've just got back from another trip to the south of France, Stuart. How was it?
It was very nice, thank you. That's right. We had a lovely evening for the Owners Club members and various other VIPs on board the classic 80-metre 1929 German-built Talita, which was in Saint-Tropez. So it's always in Saint-Tropez for Le Voile, which is just a brilliant regatta. Now over 2 weeks in the south of France. They've kind of split it up this year. So we were there last Sunday and we had about 50 guests on the back of the boat. And also we were there celebrating the 60th anniversary of Dutch design studio Vrijpak. So Vrijpak were our partners on the event. So it was really nice to see Bart and Marnix and have a great time with them in Saint-Tropez. And the events team had organized a happy birthday tower of macaroons, which we presented. There were a lot of macaroons though. So yeah, it was good.
Do you not need to see another macaroon for a while? Did you go to town?
I never knew I liked macaroons before, but I discovered I did quite like them, but they are very sweet. You reach your macaroon limit after a while.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, I definitely hit my macaroon ceiling. Anyway, happy birthday to Vrijpak. And some photos from that event will be online shortly if they're not online already. It's just a lovely, lovely, very elegant evening. Anyway, tell us about this week's interviewee, Sophia.
Yeah, so this week's interview was conducted by our US executive editor, Cecile, and she sat down with Peter Broadhurst, who is Senior Vice President of Yachting and Passenger for Imasat Maritime. They talked about the changes happening in the satellite world and how the yachting industry is quite often the catalyst for these developments. One really interesting thing that sort of demonstrates this and comes up with it is that at the moment they have 13 satellites, but they're planning to launch another 7 over the next 2 to 3 years. But 2 of these are specifically being done to provide better connectivity in the Arctic region. And this is as a result of the sort of fueled demand of explorer yachts and more people being in that area and wanting communications while they're there. I have to confess that satellite communications isn't something that I normally think about on a day-to-day basis, but it is a really interesting insight into that segment of the industry. So make sure you stay tuned for that after we've gone through all the news and data for this week.
Yeah, do stay tuned. I mean, connectivity is increasingly an issue. Obviously, we talk about explorer yachts a lot and boats going far off the beaten track. So, staying online is so important nowadays. For safety reasons, if nothing else, you know, it's not just about watching Netflix with a decent big fat internet stream onto your boat. You know, it's really important. And actually, at the Monaco Yacht Show, I spent a bit of time with some guys from SpaceX, actually, because Elon Musk is creating an array of satellites as well, or has created an array of satellites. So there's a lot going on in that space.
Good pun.
Yeah, so completely unintentional, like all the best puns. Yeah. Do stay tuned to hear more from Peter and everything that's going on at Inmarsat. So we have a few housekeeping things to get through. Obviously, tickets are now on sale for our Life Under Sail and Explorer Yacht Summits events, as well as the Superyacht Design Festival. So there's so much packed into the last few months of the year. So on the 10th and 11th of November, we'll be going back to Monaco, where we are hosting the umbrella kind of title of these 2 days is the Festival of Yachting. But within that, on the 10th, we're talking about the sailing yacht market. The event's called Life Under Sail. And then the next day on the 11th is the Explorer Yacht Summit. So Well, so why did we start the Life Under Sail event? Well, there was no other event quite like it, really. It's just a great opportunity to get all the leading thinkers from the sailing yacht market together in one room at the same time. And this, you know, the same philosophy applies for the Explore Yachts event. Because you go to the big boat shows, Cannes may be accepted because they got to, you know, the sailing yachts have quite a big basin to themselves and there's an awful lot of them. But Monaco, despite all the sailing boats being lined up together this year, they're still rather drowned out by the motor yachts. So it's great to have a sailing specific event.
So Stu's obviously covered a bit about Life Under Sail there. I am looking after the Explorer Yacht Conference personally, which is currently taking up quite a lot of my time, but it will be a brilliant event and a great opportunity, similarly to sort of the sailing yacht community, but to bring that Explorer Yacht community together. We've got some great speakers lined up, and this week I've spent time on the phone to different people that will be on different panels. But one in particular that I've really enjoyed speaking to this week was Captain Richard Bridge. He now works as consultant, but he's been in command of some pretty impressive yachts in the past, including Octopus, Polaris, Rising Sun and Varvar 2. And he's joining one of the panels that I'm looking after, which is called Kitting Your Yacht Out for Adventure. As you can imagine, he has some pretty interesting insights, especially on sort of the difference between building a yacht for exploration versus kitting out a yacht like Varvar 2 to visit destinations such as Antarctica. So hopefully that's a little teaser for you to that's just one of the panels and one of the speakers, but lots of great topics across the day. So yeah, you can find out how to buy tickets on the Boat International website.
Yep, have a look now. And on the sailing side, we'll be talking about all sorts of things like how to sell sailing, talking about catamarans, introduced,
of course,
absolutely, of course, insisted on that being in there. You know, immediate ways to kind of supercharge your sailing yacht. So some experts, you know, refit options and other technologies that you can add to your boat to squeeze a few extra knots out of it. And we'll also be asking the question, is sailing too complicated? Is it simply, is that a barrier to entry for new entrants to the market? Because we've seen the motor yacht market is flying, the brokerage market's going really well, but this new build sailing yacht market is kind of hasn't really moved in a few years. So we're just kind of asking the question, you know, why that might be. And is one of the reasons, is it simply too complicated for new people coming into the market? Obviously, if you grow up sailing, you're very used to it. But, you know, there's a lot of new buyers in the market, and why aren't they buying sailing boats? So we'll be examining that.
Yeah, and I think part of that as well, there's also, you know, you might have grown up sailing your Oppie or whatever, but it does seem like such a massive leap then to a sailing super yacht and the new technology that goes with that. So it'd be really interesting to hear. We've got Jim Dixon from Winch Design who's on that panel. It'd be really interesting to hear his thoughts on kind of whether the whole process puts people off.
Yeah, it will be. Some great speakers throughout the 2 days. So do check out. Tickets are available now. And then, of course, you know, a mere 3 weeks after that, we'll be in Milan for the Super Yacht Design Festival. The last time we ran that was, of course, in February 2020, just before. What happened after that? I can't remember, but some big world-changing event. And then obviously we tried to do it in July this year, but that turned out to not be possible for obvious reasons. So we knocked it right back to December to give ourselves the maximum opportunity for it to happen. And again, you know, that's a day and a half of some just brilliant speakers. And Charlotte, our features director, has been sweating over that for an awful long time. So it's going to be a really good event.
And Stu, I don't think you're quite done with housekeeping yet, because we also need to talk about the new Super Yacht book.
That's right. It is out now, the new Super Yachts book, another brilliant edition of the best hardback book in super yachting. So this is just a compendium, all the best reports from Boat International and some others exclusive to the Super Yachts book as well. So some of the boats that have gone in there are Artifact, obviously, whose owner wrote the foreword for the book very kindly. Blue 2, Ladacha, Cloud 9, IJE, Geist, Lady Mura, Lana, Ragnar, Synthesis. There's a few of the boats in the book. It is beautifully presented as ever. So that's, you can get that through the website now. Have a look. It's well worth it.
We're going to move on to the news in a second, but we had a story that we felt shouldn't necessarily be included in news, but we felt we should discuss. So we're no stranger to receiving some quite weird and wonderful concepts. Our digital team quite regularly report on them, but there has been one this week which has got the office talking more than usual. And this is a 69 metre by Lazzarini design, which has a giant hole in the superstructure. It's kind of quite hard to describe, and I'm not sure I'm doing it justice there, so absolutely have a look online and you can see for yourself. But it's been named Shape, and apparently the concept's hole or front deck can be customised with options including leaving it empty or as a sun lounging area, although I'm not sure how that would work as a dedicated sunbather because you'd have the top of the yacht above you. Anyway, I don't know whether we will ever see it under construction, but we did have quite a lot of fun coming up with puns around it for social media, including hole in one, holy moly, and a whole lot of love. I don't know whether you've got any, you've already had your pun peaked, to be honest, in this podcast, Stu, but if you've got anything else to throw in there.
Yeah, no, there's no beating, my unintentional space one, so I won't even try. But I mean, it is worth, tell me what the value is. I mean, I get that this boat will obviously never be built. It's utterly impractical. It'll cost just insane amounts of money for a 69 meter boat. But it's not, obviously in the car market, these big manufacturers bring out these concepts every year and they go to the Geneva Motor Show and you might see elements of the design of that concept car kind of bleeding into production cars a bit further down the line or certain technologies or whatever. But at least they're not a million miles away from what you might eventually see on the road. This concept from Lazzarini, as interesting and novel as it is, will obviously never be built. So, but is that, am I being naive, or are design elements going to eventually appear? I don't know.
I hate to make the bad news to you, but I think the point of this is exactly what we're doing at the moment, that we are discussing it, talking about it, discussing the designers. So I think we've actually fallen foul to achieving exactly what they were hoping to with, you know, putting a design out there like that.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I'm a victim of their very clever very clever rendering. So the same studio did one a few years ago with this articulating swan neck that again was just frankly unrealistic. So I don't know, maybe the whole point is simply to get a bit of publicity, but I mean, I think it drives some designers in the business crazy. You know, you talk to some studios I remember having a conversation with Terry Disdale a few years ago about concepts just like this, and they drive him crazy because, you know, Terry's opinion was, well, if you've got time to knock out concepts like this, you're obviously not busy enough with genuine projects. And that might be the case, but I can certainly see from a young designer's point of view why it might be quite useful way of getting your name out there and get people like Boat International writing stories about you on their website. So I don't know, it's probably, you know, the point is probably somewhere in between those two positions.
But you're right, it is something that's quite unique to the industry. I can't think of another, you know, on sort of, oh, maybe you get a bit of the same in architecture, I don't know, where these sort of really whimsical build ideas, I'm not sure, but it does seem something that is quite unique to the yachting industry.
Yeah, I think it is. If you and concepts like this always seem to get play in places like the Daily Mail, who, you know, love a wild super yacht concept. But I don't know. I mean, I'd be really interested to hear from more designers on this about whether, these kind of things drive them crazy. They just roll their eyes or they genuinely think, oh, that's quite a novel, you know, use of the platform. Because I'm not a designer. I tried to draw a boat once, but it didn't go well.
We have to get you in the next design challenge.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I will be picked last, like that awful moment when you're a kid and everyone's lining up and you're the last one picked. I suspect that will be the case when I'm lining up to be picked for the design challenge.
Well, let's now move on to some of the more bona fide news stories of the week. Starting with Ocean Co's largest superyacht to date, Project Y719, has hit the water. The mammoth 117-metre superyacht was launched from the yard's Alblasserdam facility. Although she's currently the yard's biggest build to date, she'll soon be surpassed by the 127-metre sailing yacht, Project Y721, which was reportedly commissioned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Details are still pretty thin on the ground about Y719, but we know she features a steel hull and aluminium superstructure and has five decks. She is scheduled for a 2021 delivery, so presumably in the next few months. But keep an eye out on the website, and we'll of course keep you updated as and when more details become available.
Yeah, another big secret project from Ocean Co. I think they're building 600 meter plus super yachts currently. Just amazing. So that's also at 170 meters is the biggest super yacht ever built in the Netherlands. But you're right, about to be eclipsed by another Ocean Co. Y721, which the whole world is waiting for. I cannot wait. That's going to be amazing when she finally appears.
Yeah, really exciting. Regardless of who her owner might be, it is going to be fabulous to see when she arrives.
Absolutely. Next, we have Fedship, fellow Dutchyard Fedship. Its 55-meter Explorer Shinkai has been pictured leaving its shed. The custom yacht has now been moved to the outside dock for final outfitting ahead of sea trials and delivery scheduled for later this year. Previously known as Project 708, Shinkai was designed by Philip Brion's Vitruvius Design Studio, and she comes with an interior by Danielle Bootson. The yacht has a submarine, which was specifically requested by the owner, who has enormous experience of ocean exploration. He really does too. That's just not hyperbole. This guy's been everywhere. The yacht is set to undertake its first adventure this year by tackling the Northwest Passage. Wow, so that's a big adventure planned for the remainder of 2021.
So we were having a bit of a chat in the office as to whether this was Fedship's first Explorer project. I don't think it is, because they did Sherpa a few years ago. Are there any others that they've also been involved with? I mean, she's certainly one of the first.
Yeah, there's been some others that kind of cross that, blur that boundary between kind of classic kind of South of France cruiser and Explorer. But Sherpa is a brilliant example of a long-legged super yacht. Sadly, we never managed to feature Sherpa. We really did try our best, but it just never happened, because I love that boat. I saw her in Monaco a few years ago when she was there. I was there at the same time, and just a really, really cool-looking boat.
Anyway, moving on, the next piece of news that we have is that Vitters is to build 44-metre sailing superyacht Project 3093. The Dutch yard announced that it will build the fast-cruising sloop sailing yacht and that it's due for delivery in spring 2024. The yacht is designed by Reichel Pugh Yacht Design, with interiors penned by Design Unlimited. It features a modern dynamic exterior lines with ample glass and a modern superstructure, according to the yard. Speaking about the project, Vitters sale and marketing manager said, "The team worked intensively together to fulfil the owner's requirements of building a safe and comfortable super yacht that also performs well in all weather conditions."
Great to see that project at Vitters. Design Unlimited, who did the interior, they're really busy at the moment. I was having a chat with Mark and Julie from the studio, who head up the studio. I was on the same flight as them to the Monaco Yacht Show, so we had a good discussion. And it's just great to see a lot of work going through that studio at the moment. They do a really, really good job. Lastly, the very sad news that legendary Italian superyacht designer Stefano Righini has died. He worked a lot with Italian shipyard Admiral Benetti, obviously, and is estimated to have designed up to 6,000 yachts. Azimut Benetti founder Paolo Vitelli and executive vice president Giovanna Vitelli described him as a genius who has inspired and favoured the successes of our group for decades. The largest design penned by him was the 49.9-metre Mangusta 165, while his most recent project was the Azimut Grande 35 Metri. Righini is also credited with swapping small port holes with large hull windows to allow natural light inside a yacht's interior, a feature which is, of course, now widespread in yacht design. In those 6,000 yachts, he's certainly started a few trends. So it's very sad to hear about the passing of Stefano. And all our thoughts are obviously with his family and the Azimut Benetti Group and all the other design studios and manufacturers that he worked with and collaborated with. And now, as ever, our data story, which is brought to you by Boat Pro, the superyacht industry's leading market intelligence platform. Request your free trial today. The team are available. Right, Sophia, what's the story?
So as we're entering Q4, we thought we'd use this opportunity to look back at brokerage sales so far this year until the end of September. There seems to be no doubt now, I think it's not really been in doubt since Q1, that we're on for a record-breaking year. But so far, 507 yachts have been sold. In the entirety of 2020, only 422 yachts were sold. And in 2019, 407 yachts were sold.
So it's already, till the end of September, a record breaking. So more yachts have been sold to the end of September this year than in any other full year ever.
Is that absolutely right? I only know the last 2 years. Are we confident, or are you going to have to Google and apologise next week?
I'm confident. I'm confident of that.
Okay. So the total asking price of yachts sold to date is €4,929,574,873. The average asking price is €9,723,027, which is actually slightly down on the 2019 average number, where it was over €10 million. These sales, as usual, are predominantly made up of motor yachts. So there's been 485 motor yachts sold in comparison to just 22 sailing yachts, which kind of comes back a bit to what we were talking about earlier as to where the sailing yacht industry is. The largest amount of sales, as you'd probably expect, is in the 24 to 30 meter category, where 199 yachts were sold. At the other end of the spectrum, though, there were 12 yachts that have been sold over 70 meters. Looking at Q3 on its own, it's actually pretty impressive in its own right. It's had 142 sales in that quarter, which is in comparison to 114 in 2020 and just 94 in 2019. These sales, just in Q3, have made an impressive total of €1,825,457,999, which is mainly thanks to the sales of new constructions, which obviously kind of pushing that number up. If the trend continues, we think we could surpass 600 sales this year, which would be quite some number.
And if I was wrong before, I'll definitely be right with 600. 600 will absolutely be record breaking, but I'm sticking with my confidence on the 507. I think that's already record breaking, but I will check that in panic in about 3 minutes. What a year! I mean, the numbers are amazing, just a phenomenal year.
Well, it just keeps going. I remember when we saw the numbers kind of come out at the end of Q1, everyone kind of was amazed, but it's just that momentum has continued, and it just you can understand why, but everyone wants to own a yacht, wants to have that experience.
Okay, we should make a prediction now. What's your bet for the final year number?
Okay, on the spot, I want you to go first so that I can competitively go close to you, so that I can
507 to the end, to the start of Q4. So how many? So there were 142. So let's go six fifty to the end of the year.
Okay, so I'm gonna go 640. So I'm just undercutting you. So anything under 645, I can claim bragging rights.
Okay. There's a bottle of champagne in it. How about we do that?
Crikey. All right, God. Suddenly escalated.
Yeah. Alrighty, thank you, Sophia. That's all the news and data for this week. Stay tuned for Cecile's interview with Peter Broadhurst from Inmarsat.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. It's great to be here today.
Thank you for joining us and helping us with the wild world of satellite communications.
That's right. Yeah. As I say, it's not very often you can say this is rocket science, but hopefully today we'll get that one behind us and move on.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this mysterious world and the technological world of satellite communications?
Yeah, technology is probably the right word. That was what I was always interested in right from being young. And first of all, getting into electronics and seeing what the capabilities of electronics were. I'm a bit of an old timer, so back in the past, it was a little bit of a case of this is the new era. This is where the world's going, and IT was just starting to open up. So you could see that communications was a great way forward, and electronics. And I left my job in working in automotive industry to by going to the library and saying what can I study in electronics, and I saw this advert that said see the world as a radio officer, and I did. I went to a college, a maritime college, and I learned Morse code and how to repair radars and main transmitters and things like that, and went to sea with Cunard and had 6 years at sea, a fantastic time, a great learning place, being at sea. Effectively, you are the one that is there to do the job and fix things, work with your colleagues in that environment. So I really enjoyed that, and that then really got me into communications. And at that time, it was one of the we were equipped with one of the first Inmarsat satellite communication systems, and you know, moving from HF and medium frequency communications and VHF communications to satellite was again the future. And when eventually I left the sea, as I was, I had children and I resigned from the sea, I've always been involved in maritime communication since then, and working for manufacturers of equipment and resellers, and now with Inmarsat for 7 years, and looking after the safety, security, and the yachting and passenger sector.
Okay, well, tell me, what exactly does that represent for Inmarsat, this yachting sector? I imagine it's a fairly small segment, or maybe I'm wrong.
It depends how you measure it in terms of the overall revenue. So yes, it's a small part of it. In terms of our maritime business unit and the focus, then it's you know, that's why I do the role, because we see it as one of those industries that's, you know, it's challenging because most yachts want something slightly different. But it's also very interesting because the yachts aren't like normal shipping, which is very conservative and doesn't really change. Yachting is at the forefront of technology, and it wants the best, and it pushes the boundaries. And so a lot of things that are developed as bespoke and special for for the yachting and super yacht industry tends to flow through in terms of technology requirements. So it's definitely an industry where we see that we need to be able to feel the pulse of the industry and what's going on there and meet its requirements, and that's my role effectively. And it's challenging, but very, very interesting, very interesting.
What are the most what are the demands of the yachting market at the moment? I would imagine, looking at people and how we live today with devices in our hands all day long, that even when people leave or decide to go explore the world, they still want, besides the safety aspect, they still want to be able to stay in touch.
Yeah, more and more so, that's for sure. And in the times that we've been through, COVID has kind of escalated that a little bit. We've seen the super yacht industry go further afield. We've seen owners and charterers want to, you know, get away and use their yachts, which then means they're effectively running businesses from them and doing their everything that you would expect from an office environment. So the requirements jump up. The leisure aspects of that are still there, obviously, and the you know, the idea to explore. But we've definitely seen an increase in the amount of capacity that people are using, the amount of not just entertainment like Netflix and things like that, but the amount of communications for email and applications on the yacht. So but that's the way the world is going now. You know, you have a yacht to go to be away from the mainstream and be in a remote location. And if you're in a remote location, you need satellite communications, and that means you need that, but you want the connectivity to be like it is on shore, so that you have always on and the right amount of bandwidth when you need it. So we have to be very flexible because the yachts aren't used all the time. It's seasonal, and we have to be global because the yacht goes anywhere and everywhere. So there are quite a few challenges in respect to that. But at the moment, we've got the plans to meet it. And we announced our orchestra, which is how we're looking into the future, a long way out, to be able to serve the needs of the superyacht industry, most definitely in terms of what the requirements are. We know there's going to be hotspots around the world. And so our network and our mesh within orchestra with our GEO satellites and our LEO satellites and our operation in different bands will allow us to effectively make that technology that we have today as transparent as it is in the future and just make it work.
So you'd be able to move around the world and seamlessly go from one provider to another, not knowing the difference.
It's all managed by Inmarsat. So because it's managed by Inmarsat, you don't need to know whether you're going over this satellite or that satellite. You don't need to choose which satellite. You don't know whether you're going over a terrestrial circuit or a cellular circuit or whatever. So again, you know, that the user doesn't really want to know what's the technology behind it. It just wants it to work. And with the use of applications and the more connectivity and the play around, you know, the remote monitoring and all those kind of things, we have to put in place a platform play. So it's no longer just a pipe. We don't just give you connectivity. You know, we give you the capability to do the things you want to do. And sometimes those things are not what you want to do, but it's machine to machine, because that's the direction as well that a lot of things are moving. Decisions are being made by machines, and we need to connect them. And obviously, in that connection, we also need to keep them secure, because that's a challenge as well. The more that you add to your operational technology, then the more exposed you can be.
Right. I heard a cybersecurity expert speak at one of our programs in the last couple of years, and it was actually very, very eye-opening. And every little window we have into communication is actually a potential way in for someone with some mischievous intentions. So, I know you, Inmarsat, as discussed in the past, the cybersecurity, can we touch upon that? And I know that also this year, as of January, IMO made compliance with cybersecurity a big priority for at least the shipping companies. But since yachts over 500 gross tons, actually are considered ships, they have to comply with that. So yes, without going into too much of a great complicated details about it, can you tell us about what to do about cybersecurity and satellite communications?
Yeah, so I applaud the IMO's direction. The maritime industry as a whole, and the international maritime industry, which is the IMO's focus, had a very immature position on cybersecurity. Two vessels being built side by side within a few weeks would have different IT infrastructures. So that, you know, one would go to Hong Kong and they'd go up the road and get a Wi-Fi router, and somebody would buy some computers here and somebody would buy some computers there. So it was very fragmented and very, very messy. So it was rife to be exposed to cybersecurity. So these new guidelines that have come in, effectively what the IMO has said is, vessels have an ISM, an International Safety Manual, which explains how you should go about being safe on the vessel. And security is a risk as safety is a risk. So the first thing you need to do is assess the risk. So if you're on a super yacht, what do you have connected? That's the first thing. What do you have connected and how is it connected? And if you then understand that, you can then start at putting some very pragmatic, doesn't have to be extremely expensive, processes in place to manage that risk. And the maritime industry is used to risk. You know, to build a ship and go to sea and all those kind of things is a big risk. The reason we do it is because we understand the risk. So by doing this, by actually doing your own analysis of what's connected, how it's connected, who has access to it, all those kind of things, what is the value of the things that you have stored on the vessel, on the yacht? All of those things will move us towards a more mature position. And it will also educate people, because training in security is important. Just the basics. Unfortunately, cybersecurity hit banking and things like that quite hard, because they weren't really used to this. But in commercial shipping, we've had piracy for for years and years and years. It's been going on, and cybersecurity is no different. It's slightly different in the physical sense, but it's the same principle. It's holding somebody ransom. Yeah, they are pirates. There are pirates out there. So, first thing is to recognize that there is a risk, and then just go and analyze what you've got. And there are a number of companies out there, including Inmarsat, that can help you through that process. And by doing that, over time, we'll get to a far more maturer position, and the risk level will decrease. So it's good that where we're moving in that respect. And in terms of Inmarsat, because we offer managed services, we add a layer of security into our services anyway. So, gives you the reassurance that nobody's going to get in the middle and kind of hack the service. It's
the signal as it travels from a satellite back to your yacht.
Exactly. Or like you see in the James Bond film where somebody takes control of the satellite. That's not going to happen. So, you can be safe and sound with that.
When I read some of the articles that were written about the announcement that Inmarsat put out about Orchestra, and then it discussed the fact that everything is interconnected, and it also talked about autonomous ships. And I know that it's very hard for your company probably to plan for the future, but it seems like we are asking more and more of these GPS signals and satellite technology. So where are we going with this? Is there a point where we're going to be over capacity on demand?
So there's two, it's an interesting question. You've asked two things. So autonomy is happening, and it's increasing, and it makes sense. The areas around the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, and that where the super yachts are, there's more and more vessels. So this decision making and things like that are more complex. It's harder to navigate these days than it was in the past. That's for sure. And also, it's a super yacht is a large asset. So monitoring that asset and making sure that it's ready to do its job with the remote monitoring of engine systems and weather routing and proper voyage planning and all those sort of things wants data for decision making. And a lot of that data is not on board the vessel. So it can be in the cloud, or it can be on servers ashore. And you can also gather your own data and share that. So we will definitely see more and more data moving backwards and forwards. And I relate this to, no yacht today would go to sea without an autopilot. Now, an autopilot is effectively an autonomous system. It's getting feedback from the rudder and from your direction, and it's making those corrections. Going back a long, long time, you'd have had to have somebody stand there and do that. Now you're talking about weather routing, where you need to find weather information. Well, that's not on the vessel, it's ashore. So you now need to have data flowing backwards and forwards to be able to make the right decisions. Same with the engine, proactive engine monitoring. Why do you need all of that, logged on board when it can be all digitally logged? Because they've all got their sensors now. It's, everything's being sensed, and it can be collected and sent ashore. And we have a service called Fleet Data that allows that to happen, all that operational technology to flow backwards and forwards. And it's just natural that we move forward with that, even with a crewed yacht. I don't think autonomous vessels will occur in yachting because of the hospitality and the hotel factor that's required within the yachting industry. But most definitely, some of the work that's done today could be done through artificial intelligence and algorithms to make the life easier for everybody on board. Now, in other sectors, there will be autonomous vessels, and there are autonomous vessels today, and we're providing connectivity to autonomous vessels. Most of them are quite small, operating within a country's territorial waters because the IMO doesn't have the international rules. It's doing a scoping exercise for international rules at this moment in time, which we're very interested in. But you will need then very, very reliable connectivity, and that's what we are providing today. And you will need the redundancy to ensure it goes backwards and forwards, because, and you'll also need the safety, because even though there's maybe no people on board the vessel, the vessel itself could cause quite a lot of environmental damage and things like that. So connectivity is through platforms that we develop, like Fleet Data and certified application programs, will definitely drive the requirements in the future, as I see it.
How many satellites do you have up now currently?
So currently we are flying 13 satellites. We call them flights. I guess that's an old school thing. We have 13 satellites flying today, and we have 7 in build. One will be launched towards the end of this year, and over the next 2 or 3 years we will be launching all of those 7. 2 of those satellites are specifically to provide connectivity to the Arctic region, and we've seen more and more people going there, including the yachts want to go up towards Svalbard and places like that. Traditionally, we never really considered providing connectivity to those areas because, as we said, penguins and fish don't have credit cards. But actually, people are going into those areas now, and that seems to be the trend. You know, for the super yacht industry and the explorer yacht now, it's most definitely they want to go off the beaten track. Staying in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean is okay, but there's a big old world out there, and definitely we're seeing a pattern where there is a demand to want to go and go and see something slightly different in your charter or in the use of the yacht. So again, that's something that we are looking to supply the connectivity for. And then, of course, we're now looking and designing as part of the orchestra and ELIRA, what will happen in the next 5 years. And we intend to launch some satellites in low Earth orbit, and also a 5G mesh network, so that we can provide connectivity to hotspots, because we know that the number of yachts are growing, and the area that they operate in is the same. It's not going to really change. So we want to be able to provide those services into the future, and it'll all be a managed service by Inmarsat. So it's one of those things where the user won't have to know what the technology is behind it. We'll just make it work.
Yeah, you mentioned the ELIRA network. What is this specific use will be?
So ELIRA effectively two uses. So ELIRA works in our L band, which is the most resilient to rain or ice and snow and things like that. So it's the availability is extremely high, and it's what we run our safety services in, and we are audited by the International Mobile Satellite Organization each year, and we always hit the 99.9% availability for that kind of service. So what we've done is we've expanded the current service with Alira, and we are increasing the speeds at the top end to go to 1.7 megabits per second.
That sounds very fast, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, any number is big if I say lots of numbers. But yeah, 1.7 megabits per second for that kind of services, it's about four times the speed of what we have today.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, and then we're also adding a layer at the bottom end, which will provide more operational technology where we need small packets of data from a sensor, for example, where if it just requires monitoring something, and if a certain event occurs, it sends up a little burst to tell somebody, you know, that happened. That's a very small amount. It doesn't need high data speeds, and it's a very small low packet of data. So that means that we can build terminals that are extremely small and provide a range of data speeds flexibly enough at the price point, which is obviously what is where it affects the end user, at the right price point for the services that they want to do. And it could be that we, you know, there's multiple different services on the same terminal. So you could have that low operational technology type service within Alira, and you could also have the high requirement to download very large files or transfer video clips and things like that if you require. So it's extremely exciting times, because again, as I said, this is us looking into the future and saying this is our vision of the world come 2030 to 2050.
Yeah, you have to plan a little ahead.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's because it takes a long time to plan a satellite and launch a satellite and get it operational and all those kind of things.
How long does it take? Just curious.
So we're now looking at our next generation of satellites, and I would think that it's going to be from beginning to end. Normally, it's about a 3 to 5 year. 3 would be very, very quick, but normally around 5 years. So by the time we've designed the satellite, know what the requirements are, put that out to tender, find somebody who will build it, then find somebody who will launch it for us and get all those dates aligned, it's about a 5 year process.
Yeah, just about the time it takes to conceive and build a super yacht.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, although we're not so interested in the aesthetics, but
it's more. Well, why not?
More functional. Well, once you launch our satellite, nobody's really going to see it again. So that's the beauty of it.
We hope not. Otherwise, we're in big trouble.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's great. But just to touch a little bit on the history of satellite communication, I guess we don't really have the information as to what was the first yacht to use satellite communication. But can you tell me a little bit how the maritime industry came to use satellite technology?
Yeah, so if we really wind back the clock, the communications at sea was really driven through the safety of life at sea, which was due to the disaster around the Titanic. So in the case of the Titanic, there were ships close to the Titanic and it did send a distress message, but they didn't act, and there was no real formal structure around what was happening. So the safety of life at sea came into process to kind of determine what should happen within those circumstances. And a lot of the processes were built up through the International Maritime Organization. And then it was decided to make the communications as reliable as possible, satellite was the way forward. And that's when Inmarsat was kind of conceived. It was conceived to ensure that a vessel in distress could send a distress. It would be answered promptly by a rescue coordination center on the shore, and any search and rescue assets could be contacted, and all the vessels local to that ship or that yacht or whoever that was in trouble could assist through the process of SOLAS. And so we Inmarsat was put together. It was a number of countries who put a small amount of money into the big pot to allow us to build our satellites and build our structure. And we were an intergovernmental organization. And that's our primary role. It still is our primary role. The DNA of Inmarsat is around saving people's lives. We receive 6 distress messages a day across the globe. It's, you know, and we, our job is to ensure, as per the original, to ensure that that distress message is received by a Rescue Coordination Center promptly and that they do respond so that we know somebody is going to assist any vessel. And and then over time we've added more satellites, added more services, branched out from maritime into aviation and into land services and government services. So we have a number of divisions now providing different services. And then we look at each individual sector, and we create the type of services that that sector would need. So it's, you know, in the commercial shipping market, there's a lot of vanilla type services. You know, a ship is a ship. If you come into super yachts, there ain't no vanilla. We've got chocolate, strawberry, banana, everybody, every kind of flavor you want. Everybody wants something slightly different. And so we have to be flexible. And because we own the satellites and we own the services that they can provide, that gives us that advantage, that differentiator to be able to do that. If it's in, you know, if it's the right thing to do and it's in the interests of us to provide it, then we will do that. And that's my role within the Yachting and Passenger, is to look at what are the services we need for our clients. And yeah, it can be challenging. It's very interesting. We see the super yacht industry as a catalyst of creating the new services, and so I think it's really exciting to be involved in that.
Do you see a time where there'll be no spot on Earth where we will not be able to communicate using a device or another?
To be quite honest, I think we'll have services on the moon and places like that, in all fairness. There is no reason why you can't get connectivity anywhere today. It is possible. It's you know, it's one of those things around scale. If there's nobody there, then why provide services there? But as people move there and as services open up there, then definitely, you know, it's possible. So. You know, I was always one of those people that sat on an aeroplane and was very happy that I was off the grid. But now Inmarsat, my company, is very happily providing services to aircraft, because unfortunately that's what the majority of people want. So, yeah, I mean, I still have the choice. I always have the choice to be able to switch off and switch my phone off and things like that, my laptop off. But it drives you towards connectivity. So the connectivity is I don't think we should see it as a bad thing, but I'm an old timer. I like to have my downtime still. If I was on a super yacht, the last thing I would want to know is how good the connectivity was. That's for sure. If I chartered one, but I can understand why they do, most definitely. It is really essential today, because in the super yacht industry, it's all about communication. You need to know what your guests want, what type of wines they want, what itinerary they want, what are they really looking for in that experience. And all that communication takes time to build up, and the back and forth and the things. And you need to organize which marinas you're going to go into and all of those, that sort of thing. So communication is definitely higher on their agenda. And again, reliability. As I say, as soon as I arrive, I'd switch it off.
We didn't touch upon it, but I remember hearing, like, captains mentioning what the the cost of communication. That is a big ticket item for you, I imagine.
So it is always, you know, I sell communication, so that's the only thing I sell. And I have this question a lot of times, and I kind of turn it around and say, what percentage of your overall budget is your communications charges? Because it's probably less than 1%. And yet it's one of those things that they focus on. And I'm like, are you looking at this as just a pure cost? Are you looking at it, what's the value it gives you? So yes, we have to be competitive. Inmarsat has to be competitive. Satellite communication systems has to be competitive. And that's for sure. I've got no problems with that. And it's good that we're not, there's no monopolies here. There's people out there, they can choose from providers, etc. But there, you know, it is, you know, a satellite that we've launched, a constellation that we've got, we've put, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of investment in space to provide these services. And yeah, people tend to quibble about the price. I understand, because they should, you know, they want true value for money, but they shouldn't come at it just from the price, and they should look at what can I actually get from my communications? What is it giving me? And is it reliable, and is it always going to be there? And have I got the backup and support for it? And is it flexible enough for me? And does it allow me to expand? Because the future is going to be that you're going to want more, not just of the bandwidth, the number of bits per second that you're going to sell, but the applications that you're going to be using. That's for sure. So there are a number of factors you need to do and to look at. And we touched on the security. You should always build the security into it as well, because you want to make sure that your overall cost is part of that. But don't be put off by the fact that, yes, this will cost some money, but it's still providing a huge amount of value.
Oh, for sure. And then when we consider what the company is going through to provide that communication,
So and we have that flexibility. You can switch the service off and not pay for it. We have suspension. You can increase the data rate, or you can reduce the data rate. So we can, you know, when the owner's on board, you can have a high throughput service, and when the owner gets off, you can lower that. So your price varies depending on that. So there's lots of options you need to look at and in terms of where you're going. Obviously, I'll defend the cost of the service and what's behind it. We provide all of the safety services for free. But I'm quite happy to have that conversation with any captain, in all fairness, around the true value that we offer in terms of the service.
It is, after all, rocket science.
It is rocket science. And the fact that, you know, we're not going to be here for just one season or two seasons or whatever. We, you know, we're a 40-year-old company, and we have a strong roadmap of investing in our network to provide the right services for the future. So, we have to take a little bit of money from everyone else to
keep it going.
To keep it going.
Launch the rockets.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you very much. This is very interesting. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, I could talk about satellites and maritime industry for a long time, but thank you for giving me this opportunity. And if there's any questions from anyone that you may receive, feel free to push them my way, and I'm happy to respond to them.
Will do.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.